Today is Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you have my permission.
Super, thank you. Last time you got us up to the 31st of May, 1976, at Lee's Ferry, where your river trip's going to start. But I wanted to go back just a minute. Could you run this all past me again of how you heard about this river trip and how you got on it? And did you know anybody who was on the trip? And then you showed up at Lee's Ferry. Who did you meet on the trip?
Yeah. Okay, so basically this trip came about because of a contract between the Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the Fish and Wildlife Service research office lab handling it was the Smithsonian, well, at the time it was Fish and Wildlife Research Lab in the Smithsonian. And it was the old bird and mammal lab historically. But anyway, they were the ones that had the contract with the Park Service. And I knew the director of the bird and mammal lab, which was Clyde Jones.
Okay.
And he was good friends with Royal D. Sutkus, S-U-T-T-K-U-S, at Tulane University, who was an ichthyologist. And of course, I knew Sut real well because I did my graduate school work in Alabama, and I met him at meetings, and he had grad students that I worked together with and different projects. And so there was a real solid connection for me with Sut before I got to D.C. and with Clyde after I got to D.C.
Okay.
And Glenn Klemmer, who was at Mississippi State University at the time, was a grad student, former student of Sut's, and he had already been down on a couple of trips at that point, I think, at least one or two, and he also knew Clyde very well. So it was a circle of us there that had a long history before the trip started.
Okay.
And we basically had this idea, Clyde and I, of trying to get all the information we could on T&E fishes out of the Grand Canyon. And that was primarily the humpback chub, bonytail chub, razorback sucker, and squawfish. And so when this contract got firmed up and they started planning trips, he just, one day we started discussing, he said, why don't you join us on the trip? You'd have some firsthand experience to talk about these things and see what the habitat's like and just get a lot better feel for things that you're going to be ultimately writing about or making decisions about when it comes time to deal with everything from critical habitat to should these things be endangered or threatened or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I was very quick to take him up on
that.
And jumped at the opportunity.
Now you had already done some boating on the Colorado River by May.
I had been on it. I guess it was the previous year.
Okay.
But from Jensen down to Ouray.
Right. You talked about that last time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had some experience, but I was totally unprepared for what I was about to see.
Okay.
Experience. Yeah.
So on the river trip, you knew that Glenn would be there, and you knew Glenn.
Yeah.
And Clyde was going to be on the trip?
Yep, Clyde on the trip.
And you knew Clyde, and you knew Sut as well.
Right.
So four people on the trip you knew.
Right.
How did you get from Washington, D.C. to Lee's Ferry?
Well, actually, there was another person on the trip, Bob Fisher, who was an assistant in the bird and mammal lab. Fish Wildlife Lab in the Smithsonian.
Okay.
So his boss was Clyde. And so I knew Bob from just hanging around Clyde and visiting with Clyde in the office. And
okay.
So those were the four. Also, Sut's wife, John Sutkus, also was on the trip. And I knew her from just having been to Tulane or to New Orleans on occasions and met her. So, there's myself, Glenn, Bob Fisher, Clyde, Sut, and his wife, John. That was the people I knew on the trip.
Sorry, Royal's wife, what was her name again?
It's spelled J-E-A-N-N-E, but pronounced John.
Okay. All right.
And from there, I found out about, after we started getting the trip organized, that there were going to be a couple of three other people on the trip, one of which was Dr. Bob Shoup, S-H-O-O-P, and he's a herpetologist at the University of Rhode Island, and he had also worked previously with Clyde and with Sut on various projects. And from there, there was a grad student, I believe, from Arizona State University, and there was another guy, Barry Kohl, K-O-H-L, and his wife, Gail, that was also either a geologist, paleontologist, that went along. And the two of them, I think, were from Tulane. And then the Park Service had the two Park Service crews. So I guess that's about a dozen of us all total on the trip.
Okay. So Barry and Gail, how do you spell their last name again? Cole?
Cole, K-O-H-L.
Got it. Okay, and from Tulane. And then two NPS crew. Do you remember the NPS crew's names?
Yeah, I looked this up recently because I had trouble running down. One of them is Scott Thibony, I guess.
Thibony.
Thibony. T-H-Y-B-O-N-Y.
That's right, Thibony.
And the other one was Ken Hawkins, H-A-W-K-I-N-S.
Okay.
Two incredible boatmen, I might add.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you have one boat or two?
We had one boat. We had the big Park Service raft. It was inflatable. The outside of it was like 3 feet inflatable, and then had some seats that went across. It had a floor in it, of course, and it was made for river running.
Okay.
Big boat.
Yeah, all right. How did you get to Lee's Ferry from D.C.?
Yeah, I, Clyde and Bob Fisher and I took a plane out on Sunday. I guess we went out actually on Saturday afternoon. Saturday afternoon would have been the 29th of May. And then we met Sut and Glenn, because we're all coming from different places, and Bob Shute. We met everybody in Flagstaff and spent Saturday night there, and Sunday we spent going over plans and picking up provisions, last-minute things you need on the river, whatever. And that's Memorial Day weekend, by the way, in 1976. And then on that Monday, the 31st, we took off from Flagstaff, headed towards Page, and then eventually took off the road, I guess, to the, a little bit to the west there, that goes to Lee's Ferry.
Okay.
And so that was our sort of staging area to launch on the river. And somewhere along the way, we met the Park Service guys there, the two boatmen, Scott and Ken. They were, in fact, already there, had the boat there, ready to go. So it's a matter of us taking our gear out of the van and loading it up, and we're ready to go.
Okay.
And some of the interesting items that went down the river with us, comment about that. The Bird and Mammal Lab, or as it was known at that time, Fish and Wildlife Mammal Lab in the Smithsonian, was sort of a holdover from the early 1900s, and they were originally part of, Department of Agriculture, but it switched over to Fish and Wildlife Service at some point. But anyway, they had all sorts of guns that were used for hunting, basically birds, mammals, for specimens. You know, shoot them with fine shot or powder, dust mm-hmm. shot or whatever. And one of them was a couple of them were shotguns. One of them was a 410 shotgun with a sawed-off barrel.
Okay.
Excuse me. When I think about this, I can't believe it. We simply packed those into a footlocker along with all for collecting mammals, and especially bats, and we did not collect any birds on this trip. But we did have a lot of small mammal traps,
okay.
Which range from Sherman traps, which are live traps for mammals. And I think we had a few snap traps with us also. But we were well prepared to collect mammals, and we had all the materials necessary when we ran our trap lines. We could basically skin the mouse and stuff it and lay it out as a specimen. And we had another foot locker that had dividers in it, so you could basically stack these boards up with all these pinned out mammals on them. So it was a well organized. It was clear we were loaded for bear, so to speak. And
yeah.
And that was not all that went down the river. And now that no one can be held accountable for this anymore, we're all retired or gone. We believed in working very hard, but we also believed in relaxing in the evening and kicking back. And so we took 17 cases of beer down the river.
Only 17, you poor people.
Yeah, we bought a store out somewhere near Page. How much beer? it was all cans. So we didn't take any glass down the canyon, of course, and didn't want that. So that actually lasted us all the way down through. We broke open the last couple of six packs as we went through Separation Rapids.
Wow, not bad.
Yeah, so that.
In 10 days.
Yeah.
All right.
And again, there was not a minute of this trip that someone was not either planning or preparing for the next stop along the river. So,
yeah.
The Park Service guys were very, Scott and Ken, it's like, how much beer? <It's>
like, we got to put it where?
17 cases. Uh-huh. Like, oh, I guess we can fit it in. So they blessed them. They took care of us. And their task on the river every night was when we pull in, we'd grab nets, and the mammal guys would grab their traps, and Bob Shoup would start basically looking for herps. And so as soon as we would make a landing at any site, it was like a beehive of activity. And the mammal guys during the day would have to seine fish because you couldn't set the traps and run them during the day, so you had to leave them overnight. So we had some extra help with the fish work during the day. So
and so for the fish stuff, did you bring hoop nets? I mean, what did you bring for that? Fishing rods?
We had a couple. Well, we did not bring fishing rods. Interestingly enough, we only had seines, and we had one that was, I think, maybe like a 20-30 foot seine, a big one, and then we had a couple that were like 15 feet long, maybe 15, 20 feet long, and 6 feet deep. And basically we were just in and freezing to death in a pair of shorts.
Right.
Cutoffs and tennis shoes and a t-shirt and burr. Yeah, it was cold. And it got better as we went down the river, of course. Things warmed up a little bit. But I never forget the arriving at the mouth of Paria River there at Lee's Ferry, and that morning it was hot already. I mean, it was blistering hot.
Right.
And then walking out into the Colorado River, it's like, holy cow, this water's cold. It just is such a contrast that you didn't expect it. I mean, I knew it was because I'd been told about other trips and what we'd be dealing with. But, what a contrast.
So you actually stopped at the Paria to do a little seining then?
Yeah, I think we seined right there at the mouth of the Paria River.
Okay.
I think that was our first collecting site. And
did you get anything there?
Uh, as I recall, we may have gotten a couple of suckers and a few minnows, and that was about it. Yeah,
okay.
Not a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. As I recall, there was not a lot of water in the Puya River that day. But we did make a small collection there.
Okay. And then you mentioned nets for bats. Did you set those up like in the evening?
Yeah, there were a couple of mist nets that we'd set up. Usually where we set up mist nets, if we made a stop somewhere where there's a side canyon that maybe had some water in it, maybe a pool of water at the base of the bluff.
Oh, right.
Cliff there. And try to set them up near that. And because bats would come out to feed on insects over the water. And that was just an opportunity to net bats.
Okay.
That's also where we've set up to shoot at bats. And I can tell you there's nothing like having a sawed-off 410 shotgun in your hand and waiting for bats to flutter through the air to see if you can hit them. It sounds easy, but I think I knocked down maybe one. And,
I don't know that I'd want to be anywhere near there. You'd be wailing that thing off right and left. And
you know, that's right. It was, and the sound of it, sound of a 410 going off in the canyon, and especially some of these little side canyons where there's a little bit of water, it just reverberates through there, and it was really, it's like, wow, I feel like a real cowboy today. You know? It's like, it was quite the experience.
So you weren't doing catch and release for the most part. You were doing catch and preserve.
No, we were preserving specimens. Taking everything from body weights on them. We basically skinned and pinned. I think we skinned about 400 mammals on that trip.
Okay.
And pinned them out. And those are all in the collection at Tulane University, I believe.
Okay. So it would have been bats and mice. Did you guys move away from the river to collect, or was it just, you know, you get to camp and you set up your stuff and start walking around looking for creatures and do the same thing in the morning?
It sort of depended. There are some areas where we'd pull up on a beach and the wall of the canyon would be maybe 100 meters away, a couple hundred meters away in some cases maybe. And so in those cases, we'd basically just start spreading out, looking around to see, is there any water in this side canyon, or is there any particular unusual feature that in the landscape that would maybe attract something different. And so we were trying to max out the most habitats we could sample for mammals, the better.
Okay.
And sort of the same thing for herbs. And we did help Bob Shoup with herb collecting, and we photographed a lot of the stuff that while we're down there. And one of the interesting things I learned from Bob Shoup, and he would, after he'd collect things like lizards, and I particularly like the little night lizards. Those are the neatest thing in the way of a herp I think I've ever collected. But he had a little noose that he'd put around their body, front legs and body, and he'd basically dangle them in the water. And what that did would be to cool them off,
right,
and slow them down to the point that you could then splash a little water up on a rock by the river and take the noose off of and put it there, and they would just sit there. And, you know, eventually they'd raise the head up a little bit as they warm up. And it's like, God, I just got out of this cold river, and little did they know they were destined for the museum collection. But basically, we'd photograph. I think there were some of the herbs we did release. I think we were trying to concentrate on getting representative samples of everything in the canyon. But there were places where some of the more common lizards, they were just kind of like fairly abundant. I mean, they were not all that easy to catch. And I will say that by the end of the week, 10 days, that I was a lot more proficient in chasing down lizards than I was the first couple of days.
Right.
But, so there are a lot of photographs documenting herps and fishes. It was a matter of every stop in the evening, Ken and Scott would set up the camp for us and start fixing the evening meal. And I don't know how they got all that much food down the river to feed 12 people, but it was always a sufficient quantity of food, and it was good. I mean, you were hungry, really hungry.
Great.
So everything tasted great. And they would start setting up camp, and again, we would take seines and jump in the river, and Clyde and Bob Fisher would take off and start setting up a trap line. And then early in the morning, we all ran trap lines to help them out. And after they set trap lines, they'd help us out in the afternoon seining fish. So there was not a lot of downtime.
Did you find any species there that you were surprised to find?
Well, I didn't know. I had been told that we'd probably see some humpback chubs.
Okay.
And I had never seen a live humpback chub before, and sure enough, we did. And that was one of the high points in the trip.
Where was that? Where did you see it?
Well, that would have been on our probably maybe second or third day down. It was at the mouth of the Little Colorado River.
Okay.
So where that comes in on the left descending bank.
Yep.
The water in the Grand Canyon the Colorado River proper was clear, but this water with those, it's travertine sort of deposits in there, that it was just this blue water.
Yeah.
Clear, but blue. And you could see chubs in there. And we were trying to hem these chubs up with nets, and I forget now if it was Scott or Ken said, "Oh, if you want some of those, we can catch those." And it's like, "Well, how would you catch them then?" He said, "Well, let me break out." And he had one of these little collapsible rod and reel rigs.
Hmm.
And so he gets out a piece of bread and makes a few little dough balls and says, "How many do you want?" And we had a permit, because they're on the endangered species list. We had a permit, I think, to take like 6 or 8 specimens, whatever it was. We took them, and boy, they were adults. They were, 12, 14 inches, at least 12, 14 inches total length. And it's like, wow, what an animal. And we got the ones with the nice big humps on them, and it's like, this thing is just so bizarre.
Hmm.
And, but it had they not had their rod, we may have hemmed up one or two with by setting a net downstream and having Clyde and Bob Shoup and everybody that was not doing something jump in the water and scare them down towards us. And when they'd come in the net, you'd have to pick it up real fast to keep them from getting out. And then even at that, someone was jumping out.
Hmm.
And yeah, that brought back memories of the line of chubs that was in, I think, the Cold Brothers had taken at the mouth of the Little Colorado River.
Yeah.
And that was the one hot spot for them. And
okay.
And the reason it was a hot spot for them is you still had warm water, and you still had aquatic insects, and, for that time period in that place, an undisturbed stream.
Right.
It was still a natural system, and it was large enough to house a fairly large population of them.
Okay. I'm assuming as well you guys pulled into Havasu, another place for blue water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, at least in the last, 10, 15, 20 years, there's typically been a large population of blueheads, flannel mouth in there. Does that ring a bell? Did you run into a large fish population there in the mouth of of Havasu Creek?
Havasu Creek. We did get, I don't remember specifically picking them up at that site, but we did pick them up along the way.
Okay.
And it was always, though, around the mouths of creeks with warm water in them.
Okay.
And occasionally, for example, back to the mouth of the Little Colorado, where the Little Colorado flows into the Colorado there, you'd have this mixing zone that extended downstream for, well, when we were there, the trip I was on, maybe 150, 200 yards downstream.
Uh-huh. That's
from
right.
The mouth.
Yep.
And in that mixing zone, you still got, we got some small chubs, and we got some flannel mouth, and I think we did get blueheads out of there, suckers. And so, yeah, and basically, I think we got some of the minnows, cyprinids, rhynichthys, dace, we picked up. But again, those were pretty much limited to that mixing zone there. When you got into the really cold water, there was just, there was not a lot there.
Right.
You could see the large trout zooming by, and but we did not, as I recall, we didn't sample any salmonids, and we might have gotten a few small ones somewhere along the way, but not much.
Okay.
And, so, but yeah, that was quite exciting. And then the one other stop where I remember doing fairly well on fish was Bright Angel Creek.
Okay.
Down at the mouth there, above the footbridge, and we spent a fair amount of time there. That was because it was good collecting. We did, of course, we didn't stop there. We didn't want to camp that site.
Right.
So that was a daytime, midday stop, whatever. I know I was fortunate because, and I don't know why I did, but I took. We had checked a bunch of our baggage and stuff, or left our street clothes and suitcases, whatever, at the motel in Flagstaff.
Okay.
And they stored it for us and just kept it there. So I left all my important things, like my driver's license and wallet and everything, there. So the only thing I took to the river was I had my camera and my backpack, which was waterproof, and two or three changes of clothes, and that was it. And I also took along with me, though, because you never know, I took money. It was a good thing because when we got to the Phantom Ranch there at the Bright Angel Trail and Creek, I realized that I had shot up most of the film. I had no idea I was going to take so many pictures.
Oh, wow.
And I'd gone through probably 8 or 10 rolls of 36 exposures already.
Great.
And so the store in the campground there had Kodak film, and I just remember being priced about twice what it was on
top.
Which I thought, well, that's the cost of hauling the film down the trail, you know. So I think I bought almost all they had left. I bought another like dozen rolls, I know, 36 exposure rolls, and
wow.
That lasted me the rest of the trip. Fortunately, I managed to get all the way through there. But, yeah, that was one of the notable spots for collecting fish. And it was, I remember there being a lot of dace in that one. We got a fair amount of rhynichthys out of that. But it was, I was just amazed that people, there were a fair number of people there that hiked down the trail. And it's like, wow, this is, that made me want to come back and take Bright Angel Trail down to the river someday.
Oh, cool.
But I never got around to doing that.
Mm, okay.
But, yeah, from there, we, again, it was pretty much a routine every day of getting up and running the trap lines. And if you got 25 or 30 mammals, you know, skin to skin, everybody, you know, started skinning mammals. Well, I say all of them. Clyde, Sut, myself, and Glenn all had experience skinning and stuffing mammals. And I think Bob Shoup maybe a little bit, but he was usually off hunting for herps. But, you know, we just all pitched in and prepared mammal skins.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you become aware of the tides of the river level going up and down
The
will of the Glen Canyon Dam upstream? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. There were places where we pulled in where the slope on the beach was not very steep. In other words, the sandbar that we'd pulled the boat in, that Ken and Scott would pull the boat in, would have a very gentle slope down the river. And so when we'd get out, we'd all take the tow lines and pull it on up on the beach. And there was one place where, and I don't think Ken or Scott had any, they had radios with them, I remember that. But we didn't always know what kind of water releases they were going to have. And when the tide would hit the spot where we had stopped for the night.
Right.
But I remember one time there was, the water started dropping after dinner, and they said, we better pull this rig back out in the river a little bit. It's a good thing we did, because otherwise it'd been left high and dry.
Yeah.
And there was, in fact, one place, one morning we had just taken off from the campsite, and the Hatch River group that was taking people down the river, they didn't, either the boatmen didn't know or they were not quite prepared for the drop in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And they were stranded.
Okay.
I mean, they were high and dry. So we pulled in, and the fact that we could all get wet and wade and whatever, we all pulled, and we got, I guess there was probably another dozen people on theirs, and literally all hands on deck to pull it out. We finally got them off the sandbar.
Wow.
But there was quite a drop there sometimes. It seemed like several feet.
Yeah, yeah.
In places, and it was... one other thing I forgot to mention, back to Phantom Ranch, Clyde had been on these trips a couple, three times before this one, and knew that he was going to run out of room for his mammal skin. And he had left with the Park Service a couple of these footlockers for storing mammal skins to keep them dry as we went down the river.
Right.
And they choppered in two or three empty footlockers, and they picked up the ones we had and took those back to the office in Flagstaff. So they also resupplied us, I think, at that point with rations. And so that was sort of the one stop along the river where we had connection with the outside world and were restocked and continued on down river then.
Okay.
But yeah, that the one thing that was interesting, there were places where when you'd walk across some of these sandbars and areas where you had a fairly flat floodplain along the river, and it wasn't so vertical, you could actually, you'd find driftwood back in there. And it's like, wow, the river does flood at times because you'd find all this driftwood. And we'd pick up some of it for some of the smaller pieces, fires at night.
Uh-huh.
And but it was really interesting that it gave you an idea of just how high the water did get in the canyon from time to time.
Yeah.
Or had in the past.
Yeah.
And
you know, it's...
As I said, I hadn't realized until recently that I think you had mentioned that Glen Canyon was closed in, like, 63,
January 63, something like that.
Yeah. So it had only been closed for, like, 13 years when I went down the river.
Right, right.
And it's like, wow, that's... I thought about that after you mentioned 63, and I guess I had just assumed it had been there longer. And then I should have known better because I do remember reading about the controversy over it and the battles that took place to try to prevent it. But
one of the things that I wondered about, and just every now and then I'll find an old photograph of some sort of king snake, or people seem to find non-venomous snakes fairly often. And they were burning driftwood piles. It was just a fun thing to do. A couple river runners,
yeah.
I should say, thought that burning driftwood was a good idea. And Glen Canyon, Bureau of Reclamation, thought it was a good idea. But the Park Service didn't think it was a good idea.
Yeah.
But all those big driftwood piles disappeared by the time you guys had shown up. There weren't that many of them left. And I just wonder about the changes in the snake populations with the loss of those big piles of drift. I haven't a clue.
Got,
I just don't know.
We got a few snakes, but not a lot. And
okay.
I'll say this, there was no real shortage of food because there were a lot of small mammals.
Right, lots of mice.
And, yeah.
And again, this was in the days, today, river runners put down tarps in their kitchens, and so when they
mm-hmm.
when they leave, they lift these tarps up, they take them to the river, they wash them off, and so they try to take their food scraps with them. Now, not so much back in the 70s.
I don't recall them putting a tarp down for. I mean,
no, it wasn't done then. The season would have been started and running full swing when you guys were there, so.
Mm-hmm.
So the mice would have been in camp going for food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it was in setting the trap lines, we never had to go more than maybe 20, 30 meters from the camp,
mm-hmm.
From where we're, the kitchen was set up and the portable potty and things like that, that basically and I know you could sit there at night around the fire and you hear something go, snap,
uh-huh.
I've got one,
uh-huh.
oh,
uh-huh.
there's one in there. And I know there were times when we actually, if we heard a couple, we thought, well, we better go get those, get them while they're fresh, so to speak. And we'd just stuff those at night just
uh-huh.
by the campfire just to get them,
uh-huh.
get them done, left to do it the next day. And not run the risk of some other larger mammal coming along and having dinner on them, which we
right.
we had a couple of traps that had been robbed.
Okay.
When we got to them. So,
hmm.
But the one thing I wanted to see that I only got a little glimpse on was a ringtail cat.
Okay.
And that was something I'd always seen pictures of, and was really curious about just what these things look like in the wild, and they. I got enough of a glimpse of one up on some rocks, sort of up above us in a distance, and it's like, wow. And we didn't have any kind of trap set to get anything other than small, basically small mammals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We couldn't have gotten anything as large as a ringtail cat, but Separation Rapids was the one thing that when we got there, the boatman pulled in on the right-hand side, a right descending bank, and it's like, what are we pulling in for? So, well, we have to go up and check to see where the river is so we know how to run it, the rapids. And I thought, that's interesting. So we pull up, tie up the boat, and we all go up and follow them up to hook. And Ken and Scott were talking about, well, we need to go over here, and then we can cut back hard to the right. We should be able to miss that. Yeah, I think this is fine.
Wait. This wouldn't be separation because that would be in the headwaters of Lake Mead, and I'm assuming there was no rapid there. But this may be
Lava Falls.
Lava Falls.
Lava
okay,
Falls.
Thank you.
Yeah. Lava Falls, not Separation Rapids. Lava Falls. And the reason the problem was that at Lava Falls is that depending on the river flow, the CFS,
mm-hmm.
the volume of water, it changes how you run the river.
Right.
And so I know when I went up on the bank with them, up on the rock there and looked down, I thought, I said, hey, I think I'm just going to meet you guys down the street here. And he said, no, Jim, you can't do that because you know what you can walk past is there's a drop-off down there, whatever. Anyway, so, but it was like, you're going to take that rig through that rapid? God, it was really quite a, and it's like, okay, everybody, nothing in your hands but rope. You're holding on to something, and brace yourselves. And it was a rough ride, but I didn't know those floats on the ramp would bend like they did. But we got through it fine. We didn't lose anything or anybody. Good. And I know on one of the preceding trips, they did lose. Everybody was with a life jacket. Made sure of that. And but on a previous trip, they had lost a guy overboard, and they managed to pick him up downstream. But he just was sitting close to the edge and was not holding on quite as tightly as he should have been.
Uh-huh.
And so got flipped. And,
yeah.
But yeah, it was a lot of falls on Separation Rapids. So.
Okay.
The Separation Rapids is about where the backwater is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Or was then.
Right.
I don't know where the backwater is now.
Backwater but, now starts at about River Mile 300,
mm-hmm.
and Grand Canyon's at River Mile 277. So that's another 25, 23 miles downstream from the Grand Wash, out by a place called South Cove.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
But it was something to see. Something called lava falls. I mean, you just don't think of volcanoes and Grand Canyon going together, of course, but historically it did. And so it's one of those things where another unexpected twist and turn in the canyon. It was, but I think the all the rapids were, you had to hold on because the, I don't remember the volume of water we had going down, but it was a fair amount. I don't know if it had been a wet year or what, but we we had some pretty good rapids there. So.
Okay. Did you keep a journal?
I did, and I sent it to, and I don't know why I didn't think of this. When I sent the slides off to Kim, I did not think to hang on to my, actually what I did, I had the River Runner's book, The Waterproof Guide.
Yep.
And I used that and put my notes in there.
Okay.
And I thought about that yesterday when you were going to be talking to them. I thought, gosh, I should have saved that. What I was thinking. And I had a little bit more detail on where we were from day to day. But, yeah, that was kept.
Did you send that off to Kim then?
Yes, I did.
Great.
It's at Grand Canyon National Park.
Oh, good. Okay. That'll be helpful. Just to tie all that in together there.
Yep.
What else do you remember about the trip? Just people in general? Scenery, rapids?
Yeah, I didn't mention this, but we did sample plants. And part of that was Royal D. Sutcus and was collecting plants while I was there. And basically, that was just another activity. As I said, there was never a minute that you were not either doing something or getting ready to do something or planning to do something.
Right.
I mean, it was Park Service got their money's worth on that trip.
Yeah.
It was quite an operation, and we all did it, pitched in and did everything. And that, I mean, even Ken and Scott, I mean, when it came down to at night, if you know, breaking things down after dinner and all, if I didn't have mammals, if we'd already set the trap lines and you're just standing around, you just help them wash dishes and clean up and whatever.
Yeah.
So it was a great trip.
So Royal would have brought along some plant presses then.
Well, the plant presses basically were some of the foot lockers that we had to keep them dry.
Okay.
But
sure.
That was basically, there was one, I think one foot locker that had nothing but two plant presses that fit neatly into it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all the papers and presses in there. And so, yeah.
Okay.
And that's, again, all at Tulane University in the museum there.
All right. Did you guys write a paper up about this?
Glenn and Sutt and Clyde Jones, I think, did the they worked up the fish data.
Okay.
Clyde, I think, and Sutt and maybe Bob Shoup did the published a paper on the mammals, some of the small mammals in the Grand Canyon National Park.
Okay.
And I don't know if Bob Shoup published a paper on the herps or not. Not being a herpetologist, and I didn't follow that, but there was the report that went to the Park Service for the contract has all that data in it.
Okay.
So that's part of the Grand Canyon National Park archives now, I'm sure, that the report they turned in.
Yeah, yeah.
And but it was the last night that we spent on the river was at Scorpion Island, and that was right near Pierce Ferry. And but we got there that afternoon, and it was another night of setting mammal traps and looking for bats and herps, whatever, on Scorpion Island. And the next day, it was just a short run from there up to Pierce Ferry to take out.
Right.
And, but, yeah, that was, wow, what a trip.
Yeah. Did you,
I was going to say, it's really amazing to me. We took our time. We stopped quite a bit, but the time it took to get through there was like, I thought at the rate we were going at first, it's like, oh, we're going to be out of here in 3 or 4 days. But the stops got a little bit longer, and there's got more to do. And as it worked out, it was perfect timing.
Nice.
So
okay. Did you notice more or less wildlife, I mean, all spectrums thereof, out on the reservoir at Scorpion Island than you did back upstream?
No, in fact, it was even less. It seemed to be, as I recall, we didn't do as well there. It was. You could tell you're on a reservoir. I'd put it like that. It just didn't have the. Wasn't the same feel that you had on the river.
Yes. Okay.
It's totally different.
All right.
And really was one of those things where I guess we were there. We knew it was the last night, so, you know, we had a few more slots for that we could pin out some mammals, so that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Same fishes, and the fishes there were just reservoir fishes. And in fact, I was trying to think, we didn't get anything in the way of native fishes. It was more bluegill or bass or whatever, as I recall. I'm not sure they were kept, but yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine that there would be hardly any native fish there at all.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I did see going through there that really made me stop and wonder was there were places where the boatman pointed out, or maybe Sutt pointed out, but I think the boatman, that since you can see those holes in the cliffs up there on the side of the canyon, on the wall, that's where Bureau of Reclamation was taking rock samples to for more dams in the canyon.
Right.
And when they pointed this out, it just hits you all of a sudden like a ton of bricks. It's like, my God, they were thinking about more dams and covering this up?
Yep.
I mean, it was, to me, just unthinkable. And it just really drove home the point of we came close to losing, and had we not objected to Glen Canyon Dam, and had there not been the battles over that one, we might have had two or three more dams in the Grand Canyon.
Well, that's right.
So that was really, I think, telling to me that we've got a situation where we still have, how many miles in the Grand Canyon? A couple hundred?
Yeah, 277 from Lee's Ferry to the Grand Wash. Yeah.
Yeah. So 277 miles of people in Colorado River that we would not have had otherwise. It's going to be interesting to see, and some of the technology that's coming online now or is being developed. It's not quite online yet, but there are storage batteries that they're developing for hydropower plants that basically allow them to have more of a run-of-the-river flow regime and store power in the batteries.
Okay.
And then when you need it for early morning or late afternoon loads that are higher, more demand, then or anytime you need more power and higher demand, you just flip the switch on the battery. And what that does, it prevents the big tides that you experience downstream.
Right.
And that's, I don't know if they've done anything about trying to flatten any of those out, but.
They have. You guys were seeing some fairly large swings. The Grand Canyon Protection Act came in to moderate those swings and limit how fast the dam could turn on and limit how fast the dam could turn off to try to maintain a little better sand supply. Of course, the sand makes the backwaters for the fish.
Right.
But the whole thing is so curious because of the trout that are stocked upstream of Lee's Ferry that then float past Lee's Ferry and down past the Paria and then start eating whatever they can.
Yeah.
And of course, the quagga is coming down through the dam now. And there's much discussion about how that's going to be impacted by the sediment load in the Paria. And those mussels don't like that much silt.
Right.
So that may be helpful, but the once a year habitat flows to take the monsoon sediments that have come in on the monsoon rains. This summer we had good monsoon, so there should be a lot of sediment there. Well, I got to take a lot of water out of the reservoir and run it through the dam as fast as they can to stir up the sediments to try to rebuild some of those beaches. But that only goes as high as the lowest summer runoff ever got before the dam.
Wow.
Yeah. So the whole thing is.
The whole thing that another thing that I did not understand prior to going down the canyon that these side washes when you have these basically these flash floods that come down into the canyon that bring all the sediment and the gravel and the rock in, that's what keeps the whole thing going in terms of building floodplain and beach areas and the sediment that gets washed in. And it's like, I mean, think about it, it makes sense, but it's just something that never occurs to one until you float down the river and you realize that every place that we're camping is just below the mouth of a canyon, side canyon, that has a fair amount of water coming out of it.
Makes a back eddy there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And slows down the river, the water velocity, and allows the sediment to drop out of the water column.
Yep. It's an amazing system.
Yeah.
It's an amazing system.
Yeah, and to get a chance to see what it was like before the dams, before Navajo and Glen Canyon and Flaming Gorge, what the ecology was like then and compared to what it is now, that's a real hard thing to do. Because the data set isn't there.
The one thing it allowed me to do was compare eastern rivers, large coastal plain eastern rivers, to a large western river. And, of course, the ecology of them has some basic operating principles, I guess you'd call them.
Right.
They're the same. But beyond that, they're very different systems.
So, what did you find in your comparison?
Well, basically, just looking at rivers like the Tombigbee River, which I spent a lot of time. Well, I spent a couple of years on it when I was living on the banks of it in Mississippi, and it's a large coastal plain river that has tons of tribs in it. You know, you're talking about 50, 60 inches of rain a year, and it's one that basically a river that survives off of the floodplain. It depends on flooding of the floodplain to wash in nutrients, to wash in sediments, and also the backwaters in the floodplain are where a lot of the productivity takes place. And the young fish that are maybe spawned in the edge of the river drift into these backwater areas, and that's where they basically grow up. And there's a lot of things that actually spawn in the floodplains.
Now, that sounds similar to the Colorado River.
Yeah, yeah. Not a lot of difference there, but I guess a lot of it has to do with just the sheer diversity, because in the Tombigbee River in Mississippi, we were talking about 45, 50 species of fish.
Wow.
And versus a dozen or so in the Colorado River.
Yeah.
And it was quite, and you know, the fact that I could not find any mussels in the Grand Canyon, I was looking for freshwater mussels and thinking there might be something in there in the way of but no, it's just too high energy a system to support mussels. So
I wonder if there were mussels further down, near to the Sea of Cortez before the dams.
There might have been a couple, but again, the Western United States has maybe half a dozen species, dozen, maybe 10 species of mussels.
Wow.
And, yeah, and state of Alabama has 180 species of mussels. So.
I don't know the right word, but when I think of the Colorado River, I think of a desert river. This is basically a kind of a low-water desert river with occasional punctuations of severe flooding. And when I think of the east, I think more of a jungle, just rich, species diverse, lots of water. Maybe better soils.
So the Tombigbee, it was like all coastal plain rivers in the southeastern United States. It's a fairly meandering system.
And
in each bend, you've got a cut bank, which is the vertical wall that gets cut.
Right.
And opposite that, you'll have a sandbar.
And
so because the material that gets eroded off the cut bank gets deposited downstream of the cut bank into a bar.
Right.
And so it's just this alternating cut bank, sandbar sort of scenery all the way up and down the river. And then you have, at the mouth of tributaries, you have a lot of gravel. That's very similar, actually, to the Grand Canyon, only our gravel is anything from pea size to maybe half inch in diameter, where out there it was cobble and boulders.
House-sized boulders here and there.
Just a little different. Just a little different.
Yeah, yeah.
But what a neat system.
Yeah. Had the chub had already been listed by 76?
Yeah, the chub and squawfish, bony tail, humpback, razorback sucker, and squawfish. I think those were all listed under the original act. The 69 Act, I think.
That's right. I think
they were in the Red Book, and those got grandfathered in.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. And people would have seen that. That's right. People would have seen that change happening early on.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What else do you remember about that trip?
Well, I remember getting back to when we took out at Pierce Ferry, and we were met there by some Fish and Wildlife Service people that hauled us back to the motel in Flagstaff, and a hot shower was nice. And I remember going to a restaurant and eating a very large dinner, and drinking large quantities of margaritas
at altitude.
Yeah, that's right. And,
oh boy,
we actually. at the end of that trip that night, I remember sitting around talking about, we got to do this again. When is the next trip down?
Hmm.
And the excitement of that one didn't wear off for months. I mean, it was like, and by the time the next one came along, which was, I guess, a year or so, maybe a couple of years later, I was unable to go on because my workload in the Endangered Species Office had just gotten out of hand, and I was like, gosh, I can't take another. I've already done it once, and the boss says, look, you've been down it once, and what are you going to learn on the second trip?
Yeah.
And so, well, okay. And we talked about doing it a little bit differently in that we're talking about setting up maybe campsites, and rather than stopping during the day, you stop one time, once or maybe twice a day, but at least once at night when you camp, and maybe staying there for a day, and then, you know, make up the time the next day by not stopping.
Uh-huh.
And the only reason for doing that is just to explore. If you sample one night, you get this kind of diversity, and if you seine these fish, and then if you seine another night, would you add to that diversity? And,
right.
And just another effort at trying to more intensely sample, I guess, was the point of it.
It's almost like you need a night crew and a day crew, and the night crew would have a hard time sleeping in the days on your transit days.
Right.
I should ask you, did you guys collect any beaver at all?
We did not collect any beaver.
Okay. I'm sure you noted them and marked them.
Yeah, well, we noted some where they had chewed up some of the trees. Some of the small brush and stuff along some of the side canyons. But we did not see a beaver.
Okay.
In the flesh. And I was trying to think, it seems like, and I had this in my notes, I think, it seems like we saw, this may have been after Separation Rapids, but I think we did see burrows in the canyon.
Right. They are in the mud banks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is above Separation. It says above lava. They're in that, in the reaches where, there's enough sand still left that they can burrow in.
Yeah, and it, I think there's, I believe it's salt cedar that,
Tamarisk
that's in there, that, there are places where that was, maybe stabilizing sandbars, maybe shouldn't be stabilized, so they're tying up some of the sediments in the root systems.
Mm-hmm.
That, that was something that we noted on the way up and down down the river.
Okay.
And I think one of the surprising things is the light in the canyon. It's amazing. You can go around a bend and almost be in the dark.
Yeah.
And I guess you realize at that point just how deep you are into the to the earth when you you go around a big bend, and it's like, oh, the sun in the west has disappeared all of a sudden. And
getting some shade.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was a welcome relief at times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
But the overall, the heat was just being born and raised in the south, I'm used to heat and humidity, but this. It was a dry hot with a cold water at your feet. It's like, wow, this is, it's quite a contrast.
Yeah.
Quite a contrast.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, hot, cold.
Yeah.
Contrast. Anything else I should ask you about this river trip that I haven't?
Again, pretty much everything that was collected on that trip is archived in the collections at Tulane University.
Okay.
And should anybody ever want to go back and revisit what's there, also through the archives, I'm sure, at Grand Canyon National Park and the research center there, because all the reports were submitted to them.
Okay.
And and they have copies of publications, of course, as things did come out.
Right.
And a lot of that was based on not just the trip I was on. The one I was on was part of a larger picture, and so they have far more. I think they have like maybe 12 or 15 trips over a period of 10 years there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
15 years. So it was quite extensive. And so.
And Glenn Klemmer was on some of those trips, is that right?
He was on some of those trips, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll definitely want to try to get in touch with him. That'll be good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see. What are we at time-wise here? We are a little over an hour here. Maybe this is a good time to wrap this up.
All right.
Anything else you want to add just in general to this interview?
No, it's been very interesting, and I realized that I would have to say that one trip is some of the details have stuck with me more firmly than a lot of others have.
Cool.
It's a trip of a lifetime.
Nice. Very nice.
Trip of a lifetime. It makes me sad to think about what we've lost with the impoundments in the Grand Canyon or along the river period. I think about what Flaming Gorge must have been like.
Yes.
And who knows, you know, maybe someday we'll have better ways at generating power and getting water to faraway places that need it without having to have dams.
I think that's right, and I'm really looking forward to the day where we do, and we have the ability to look at remediation, about dam removal and mm-hmm. the whole river system reconstruction, all the way down to the Sea of Cortez. It's going to be a really dynamic, exciting time.
Yeah. And it's really, I think we're just beginning to see the blossoming of this whole effort of dam removal in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that we're trying to welcome to the South, but we have a lot of reluctance on the part of our elected officials.
Sure.
And it's just something that's ingrained in their being that you always have to have more dams. And although I will say we've come a long way. Prime example is the Tennessee Valley Authority that they have not built a major dam in decades now. And the last one was Tellico Dam, which we fought fiercely over. And while we lost that battle, I think we won the war. There was another dam that they were in the process of building that had already poured the concrete. They just hadn't put in the earthen portion of it, which would have backed the water up. And they actually tore that one down. And so somewhere around here, I have a chunk of concrete out of it.
Well, I think of the Bureau of Reclamation the same way. They wanted to build Bridge Canyon and Marble Canyon, and they didn't. And that, mm-hmm. you know,
Thank God.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we look at these things and wonder.
Dodged a couple bullets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, with that, this will conclude Part 6 of the Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Williams. Today is September 15th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.